If you want to open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 22, that's where we'll be tonight. I decided to change the kind of scheduled lesson on Old Testament lessons on evangelism to instead cover the text here. It's kind of an introduction to just the concept of biblical prophecy in the Old Testament, what it has to say about Jesus, to really kind of go along with the series we had this weekend with Vinay. And so hopefully as we look at Genesis 22 and the sacrifice of Isaac, we'll build on that. Now, as Vinay and I were talking before this weekend, he mentioned, you know, one whole thing we won't be able to get into is Old Testament prophecy and how that teaches us about Jesus and his evidence for Jesus being the Son of God. And so I'll be able to hit on that now in this lesson, at least in a little bit. And to touch on that is one more reason for us to have faith in God, what the Old Testament says about Jesus. And before we even jump into this text, let me just say that I really think that this weekend was a blessing for us. It gave us opportunities for us to do outreach, for us to invite people and talk to them. I think Vinay gave us things for us to consider and think about and to learn. And I think that even if we felt like we wish more people from the outside would have come, I don't want us to see that as a negative thing, because I think it takes people oftentimes multiple invitations for them to accept. Just so many times in New York, I remember people saying, you know, I've been holding on to this ad for 6 months or a year. In fact, I've gotten calls from people, even while I've lived here in Indiana, who had a flyer with my phone number on it from months before. So they hold on to it, they think about it, and so just because you invited someone this weekend and they didn't come this weekend, you know, the seed's been planted, and maybe the next invitation or the next invitation, that will be the one. And so don't see this as one-shot opportunity. Let's try to build on that and keep using that as an opportunity. I think that'll be a useful thing for us as we move forward in trying to help people spiritually. And so what we want to kind of introduce tonight is the topic that many of us are aware of and familiar with, but the fact that the Old Testament speaks about Jesus. Years, in fact, hundreds of years before Jesus came, we know that there is foreshadowing of Jesus all throughout the Old Testament. There's descriptions of Jesus, there's prophecies of Jesus, and archaeology confirms what the Old Testament tells us. These documents are old, very old. We know that they came before the time of Jesus, and so the idea basically is if there's enough evidence to show that the Old Testament spoke about Jesus hundreds of years before he came, that only God can do that. And that's pointing to then God being behind the Old Testament and God being behind Jesus' claims in the New Testament. All of this pointing to a divine document that Jesus is who he said he was. But here's what is interesting is that God speaks of these things and delivers these things to us in a way we wouldn't necessarily expect, showing his wisdom behind all of this. And if the predictions of Jesus were too obvious, if they were too specific or narrow, it'd be easy to fake them, right? And almost like a checklist, you know, just look for this checklist that someone's going to do, and anyone could come along and do that checklist. Well, that's not a very significant claim. I was talking to a young man at the fair booth back in July when we had the county fair booth there, and I was telling him one of the reasons I believe in Jesus is because the Old Testament prophecies about him, and he says to me, yeah, anyone could come along and just do those. I'm like, how do I, in 15 seconds, like really quickly describe this big concept to you? That the way the Old Testament talks about Jesus is not so narrow and specific like this checklist that just people were waiting, you know. It didn't say that in the year so-and-so, he'll be there on Passover wearing a red shirt. And of course, how many people are going to be there on that day wearing a red shirt because they're trying to fulfill that? That's not how it works. But, you know, it's not too ambiguous or indefinite either, because that's fairly useless as well. You know, anything could be the fulfillment. You think about the way that Nostradamus wrote book after book, page after page, of very general, ambiguous statements about the future. Well, you write enough of those, and enough time goes by, that's going to sound like you predicted something, because it's that kind of general thing. And so what we have in the Old Testament is this balance to where it's not overly obvious, overly specific, but then when it comes along, it shows it's not too ambiguous or indefinite. Here's another way of saying that. The Old Testament speaks of Jesus in a way that'd be impossible to guess ahead of time, but undeniable to miss afterwards. And I think you really see the wisdom of God in doing that. Of course, it's going to be undeniable to miss afterwards for those who are willing to see it. And that's really what we have in the Old Testament, is God showing us things where ahead of time, you wouldn't see it coming. Like a good movie, right? Like a good mystery story, where all the details are there, but you don't see it until afterwards where it's revealed. So tonight we're going to look at the story of the sacrifice of Isaac. I think it's a great example of that. But what I do want to make clear from the beginning is that this is not the only Old Testament story that foreshadows Jesus. And here's why I want you to understand that, is because if you say, you know, Jay, that's kind of interesting, I do kind of see your point. That seems like it's pointing to Jesus, but really, is your whole faith resting on one paragraph, these 14 verses that we're going to look at here? The answer is no, not at all. The whole Old Testament, really, page after page of the Old Testament, like a kaleidoscope, is showing us Jesus from a different perspective and a different viewpoint in a way that just shows the whole Old Testament is about Jesus. And so really that this story is just really one of many that shows us Jesus in the Old Testament, and it's a compelling argument to believe Jesus' claims when he comes about in the first century. So read this story with me. It's an incredible story. It's a fascinating story. Every detail, it seems, is important. In Genesis 22. Look with me in Genesis 22, verses 1 through 8. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." He said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So they went, both of them, together. It's an incredible story. Abraham has been living this life of faith, right? Abraham, the man of faith, God called him back, and then Genesis 11 and 12, "Go to a land where I tell you, I'll bless you, I'll take care of you, and through your seed, through your descendants, I'll bless the whole world." So Abraham has been wandering in the land of Canaan now for many years, decades, 10 of our chapters in the Bible, and living by faith there. God's been taking care of him and blessing him. And Abraham's been obedient. Abraham has been showing this faith in God. And so it seems that God is going to offer kind of this ultimate test of him, to test his faith in him, to test his obedience. By the end of this, God's going to say, "Now I know that you fear me, that you're willing to obey me, and give of your best, give kind of the ultimate sacrifice to put God above his greatest earthly good." And so God says he's going to test him. And so he calls Abraham and he says, "I want you to go to the land that I show you." That sounds familiar, right? That's what God said to him back in Genesis 12. And he says, "Take your son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall show you." And so that's the call that Abraham's given. And what's fascinating is Abraham just obeys. I mean, he gets up early the next morning to obey, as Abraham has done before. What's interesting through this paragraph is this emphasis on his son. I just said over and over again, Isaac is his son. And Isaac calls to Abraham, "My father." And this emphasis there, I think, drawing us into the drama of the moment of how
awful
a thing this would have been for Abraham to do, willing to offer up his son, and the pain of that, and the difficulty of that. And as we look through the details of the story, it's interesting to see it's very sparsely told. Right. I mean, there's not a lot of flowery things. You could have spent a whole book on this, the psychological thriller of going through this and the pain and the detail and this. And it's not flowery at all. And in fact, it's just very carefully told. And so we're told the details of the story. So in verse 3, Abraham rises up early in the morning, saddles his donkey. Two young men go with them and his son, Isaac. And it tells us, interestingly, that he chops the wood there, and then they go onward towards this land of Moriah. It says, in the third day, Abraham sees it from afar, and he stops the two young men, and he says, you stay here with the donkey, I'm going to go on ahead, just me, alone with Isaac. And so he then takes the wood, gives the detail that it puts it on Isaac, his son, and they go on together, Isaac carrying the wood, Abraham with the fire and the knife. And it says they went both of them together, verse 6. In verse 7, Isaac says, my father, he says, here I am, my son. He says, behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the offering? If we're going to go offer this burnt offering, you know, where is the lamb? Father, where's the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham says to him, he says, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. Now, honestly, I'm not sure what Abraham means by that, but he says, God will provide this lamb. And then again, end of verse 8 repeats, so they went both of them together. And we're drawn into almost the silence of the moment of them walking up this mountain for Abraham to offer his son. Read with me then verses 9 through 14. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. So Abraham obeys. We're told in verse 9, when they get there to the place of which God told him, Abraham builds the altar and says he lays the wood there in order. And it says he binds Isaac, his son. Now, Abraham is an old man at this point, over 100 years old. I mean, he's old. And Isaac, we're not told how old he is. He's a young man. But I'm guessing that Isaac could have gotten away from his father. I mean, it just wouldn't take that much for him to be able to squirm. It's just them alone there together. It's a picture of a willing sacrifice is what it is. And he binds Isaac. It says, lays him up there on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham is ready to kill his son. And it takes a knife there to kill him. But the angel of the Lord stops him and says, Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham says, here I am. He says, don't lay a hand on the boy or do him any harm. Now I know that you fear me. You trust me. You'll obey me. You see the faith of Abraham in this story. He told the servants back there in verse 5. He said, we will come back to you again. And so it's a picture of Abraham saying, you know, I'm going to do this, but God told me this is my son. God told me that through Isaac, my seed will carry on and bless the world. And so I think then that I'm able to offer him, and God's going to bring him back to me. And so he says to him already that he'll come back with me after this. And so you see Abraham's faith, see Abraham's obedience, that Abraham is willing to serve God no matter what. And then after that, verse 13, Abraham lifts up his eyes, and he sees a ram there caught in the thicket. So he goes over there, gets this ram caught by the horns, and it says in verse 13, he offers the ram up as a burnt offering instead of his son. You see that the emphasis there, it's not just that, oh good, I'm spared from having to actually kill Isaac, so here's something else. I'll offer this to thank God. No, it specifically says in verse 13, the ram is offered up instead of Isaac. So there's still that offering, but the ram is offered instead. And so in verse 14 it says, Abraham calls the name of that place, the Lord will provide. That in Hebrew, Jehovah Jireh. Now that's one of those phrases in Hebrew that some people may recognize. I've seen that on people's armbands or things like that, that the Lord will provide. And it also can be translated, the Lord will foresee. You can see how those words are connected. To provide is to, you know, to supply the need. But if you're going to be able to provide something, it's because you foresaw the need for that. And even those words are connected, to see ahead. You see what the need's going to be, and so you can then provide that. And so it says Abraham names that place, the Lord will provide. And then there's this curious detail. It says at the end of verse 14, as it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. So it becomes this proverbial expression. The proverbial expression, on the mount of the Lord, it is provided. You know, kind of God takes care of it. God provides it on the mount of the Lord. And the story continues there, but we're going to stop there, because essentially the action is over. Abraham will return with Isaac back there, and God reestablishes the promises that I will bless you and your offspring, and through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. So that's our story here. And I don't know if any of those details reminded you about the basic story of the sacrifice of Jesus, the offering of Jesus, the crucifixion of Jesus. But when we look at the details given here, this just shouts loudly the details of the story of Jesus, who 2,000 years later would be offered up as a sacrifice. Well, that's my claim. You may not buy it yet, but that's what I'm going to suggest to you. Is the story ultimately about Jesus? You'll notice that there's no direct prophecy here. You know, it's not like it says, so here's the story of Isaac, and guess what? 2,000 years from now, a guy named Jesus is going to come and do this. And it doesn't say that. It does hint at some kind of future fulfillment. That curious detail in verse 14 where it says, as it is said this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. And so there is this hint of, you know, this is the kind of thing that God does. On the mount of the Lord, God provides for the need. But what this story does is it foreshadows Jesus. It assembles details, it connects details about Jesus to show that Jesus was all along in God's plan. It's like, how could this story be told without, you know, this is, can't be any accident. The story is told because it anticipates something else. And that idea of anticipation, pointing to Jesus, is what the story is all about. That's what we're going to see laid out for us as we examine the details of this story. So, first of all, what I want to suggest is that the structure of the book of Genesis itself points to this story as being significant. The structure of the book of Genesis is actually highlighting this as the Isaac story. A couple of things point to that. Number one, other characters in the book of Genesis get their own section. Abraham gets his own section. Jacob gets his own section. Joseph and Judah get their own section at the end. But Isaac doesn't. Isaac doesn't get a section. You know, you think they could have told all kinds of stories about Isaac. Why doesn't Isaac get a section? And the one chapter Isaac gets, we had a lesson on this a while ago, the one section that Isaac does get in Genesis 26, all those stories are really reminiscent of Abraham. It's like Abraham did all those things before. It's kind of like the book of Genesis is de-highlighting, minimizing all these other episodes with Isaac, so that this one stands out. In other words, you know, when we ask, what's the Isaac story that comes to mind? I mean, this is it. If you read the book of Genesis, this is the Isaac story. And so even the book of Genesis has these arrows pointing to this episode. Let me highlight for you then five details in this story. Number one, there's an emphasis here that Isaac is the only son. It's repeated several times in here. Verse 2, he says, take your son, your only son, Isaac. In verse 12, your only son. Verse 16, your only son. And that reminds us, of course, of what it says of Jesus. He's the only begotten son. But What's interesting about that is technically in the book of Genesis, Isaac isn't the only son. If you remember, Ishmael was born a few years earlier. Ishmael's still alive. Now, he's been kind of kicked out, disowned. You know, Ishmael's out there somewhere, but at home there, yes, Isaac is the only son, and he's the heir and all those things. But if you want to be technical, it's just three chapters later where in Genesis 25, Ishmael is called Abraham's son again. So why highlight that? Why in this story would it say over and over again that Isaac is the only son? It's a curious thing. Maybe it points to this idea of the only son. It's an unusual detail there. And so Isaac, as the son of promise then, as his only son idea, that is true of Jesus, kind of anticipating this, the only son, the only begotten son. It's a curiosity in the story. Number two, the location on Mount Moriah. I don't know if that sounds familiar, the biblical location of Moriah. But it's not one of the more famous places. You think of all kinds of Old Testament places mentioned, right? Babylon, Jerusalem, Bethel. Moriah doesn't really come to mind as an important place. And the reason for that is it's only mentioned in two chapters. It's only mentioned twice in the entire Old Testament. It's mentioned here, it calls the land of Moriah, and it's mentioned in 2 Chronicles chapter 3. That's the only time that this word shows up in the Hebrew Scriptures. 2 Chronicles chapter 3. What is 2 Chronicles chapter 3? Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David his father at the place that David had appointed on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. See, that the only other place that Moriah is mentioned, it's again this mountain idea. It's where the Lord appeared to David. It's where David offered that sacrifice. And it's where Solomon's going to build the house of the Lord. And where does this remind us? Where was the temple built? Jerusalem. And so what we find out is that this a story Isaac offered on this mountain in the land of Moriah, this is the Temple Mountain in Jerusalem. This is happening in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. What happens at the temple? The temple is the place where sacrifices were offered. The temple is the place where day after day lambs were offered for the sins of the people, where once a year the high priest would go and offer that sacrifice. I mean, this is, we find out later, this is the key spot in the Jewish culture, the Jewish religion. And so 1,000 years before David comes, 1,000 years before the high priests set up the temple there in Jerusalem, Isaac is offered on the Temple Mount, the exact same place, this place of sacrifice. It's fascinating to see that connection. Detail number three, there's an emphasis on the wood in this story. Notice that in verse 3 it tells us about Abraham stopping to cut the wood and to bring that wood along. We don't need to know that. We can suppose that. But no, it specifically tells us in verse 3 that he cuts the wood and takes the wood along with him. And in verse 6, it says that Abraham, in this short story with limited details, we get to hear about the donkey several times. And it says that they come to this point where you can see it from afar, and he stops the donkey and he takes the wood off of the donkey and he puts the wood on Isaac. And we're specifically given this picture that Isaac is going to carry the wood up the mountain to the place of this offering. Verse 6, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And then in verse 9, the wood is mentioned twice. It says, Abraham builds the altar there and lays the wood in order, binds Isaac, his son, and lays him on top of the altar, on top of the wood. Well, of course it's on top of the wood. It's on top of the altar. But yet it keeps drawing attention to the wood. The word wood is mentioned here 5 times. In this short paragraph, Leviticus 1 mentions the wood of the burnt offering, but in that whole chapter, it only gets mentioned 4 times. And there's a real emphasis on that here. And what's significant about that is that in the Old Testament, it's not like wood had the spiritual significance. I mean, that's just the mechanism by which the fire is carried. Earlier in Genesis, Abraham offers sacrifices. Wood is not mentioned there. Later in the law, wood is not a religious aspect. There's no religious significance of the offering why wood would need to be mentioned there. But what we have here is this detail, emphasis given to Isaac and the wood. What's interesting about that is in Hebrew, there's no distinction between the word for wood and tree. It's the same thing. You know, we have that in English. Sometimes we have a word that can be multiple things. Sometimes we use different words. But in Hebrew, the word for wood is the word for tree. And so later on, when we talk about, you know, gathering sticks, gathering wood, you could say gathering tree. You know, it's just tree. It's just that wood material. And so in Genesis, we've already seen this word show up as the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And later on in the law, we'll see in Deuteronomy 21, this word for what a cursed man is hanged upon. When it says, if a man is hanged upon a tree, hanged upon wood, he is cursed by God. Specified there, the only thing there, the only means of mechanism of death that says specifically he's cursed by God is cursed is the one who is hanged upon tree, hanged upon wood. And so what we're left with is this picture of Isaac climbing the mountain, carrying the wood that he's going to be sacrificed upon. That detail specifically given to him. We wouldn't have to have that detail. We don't need to know all that. But it specifically tells us that, him carrying the wood. What does that sound like? It makes us think about Jesus carrying his cross, carrying the wood that he's going to carry to the place of his death. Detail number four, we're told that the event of his sacrifice happens on the third day. Verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. You think about that, we don't need to know that. We don't need to know how many days it took to get there. But yet it says that all these events then happen on the third day. And so if you think about it, the day that Isaac is rescued from death, the day that Isaac is delivered and brought back is on the third day. Well, of course, we know that it's on the third day that Jesus is rescued from death and brought back from the grave. And detail number five, this idea of the Lord will provide. You know, I go back to verse 8. It's just hard to know what Abraham means there. So Isaac says to him, right, Father, here's the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb? Where's the lamb? And Abraham says, God will provide for himself the lamb. What does Abraham mean there? Is he lying? I mean, I don't think so. It seems like more of an enigmatic statement. The thing is that Abraham isn't planning to fake out God, right? He's not planning to disobey. It's not like he's going to go up there and do something different. Maybe he hoped for something different. I don't know. Maybe that's one way to take it. But he says this strange thing. God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. And that's interesting. He says that God will provide a lamb. Is he right? Well, kind of. God does provide a substitute, but it's not a lamb. When he gets up there, what God provides is this ram, which isn't a lamb. You know, the ram is more the adult sheep, and the lamb, you think of as a child sheep. It's a different word in Hebrew for lamb versus ram. And so when Abraham says God will provide the lamb, he's kind of right, but God doesn't provide a lamb. He provides a ram. Is he calling Isaac the lamb? He says God will provide the lamb. Is he looking at his son and saying, you're the lamb that's going to be sacrificed? I don't know. Or does Abraham's statement there point to a lamb that will ultimately be provided? When he says God will provide a lamb, well, not in this story, because in this story it's a ram. Is he pointing to some future God providing the lamb? And of course, we think about Jesus coming on the scene in John chapter 1, where John the Baptist says, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. God does provide a lamb, ultimately. And the story really teaches this principle of God setting up a substitute. That's the idea here you have in verse 13. He says that the ram is offered up in place of the son. In place of his son. Verse 14, Abraham calls the place Jehovah Jireh. The Lord will provide. God will provide the substitute. And says that's kind of the source, as it is said to this day. On the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. Maybe that was a statement that they said. The people of Israel said to themselves, yep, on the mount of the Lord it will be provided. Well, think about that. In some future time, you know, the God provides these things. God will provide. And of course, what in is the mountain of the Lord? Well, in the Old Testament, the mountain of the Lord is Jerusalem. That's where this takes place. That's the mountain of God's people. It's the capital of God's nation. On the mountain of the Lord is Jerusalem. And provide what? Well, in this story, what's provided? In this story, what's provided is a substitute for the sacrifice. A different person, a different thing, offered instead of Isaac. And so if we reword this statement, basically, on the mountain of the Lord in Jerusalem, the Lord will provide the sacrificial substitute. And what's the substitute? Well, we look earlier in this book, earlier in Genesis, that he tells them when they sin, and the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. It's a substitute for their sins, a substitute for death. It's thought-provoking to see all those things coming together in this story. And so we have all these details, right? The specifics. Isaac, the only son, on Mount Moriah, on the third day, bearing the wood, and the Lord will provide. And you think about that, that's the who of the Jesus story. The who, the only son, God's only son. It's the where. This is going to happen in Jerusalem. On the third day, the when, is when Jesus is raised. Bearing the wood is how. Jesus crucified, carrying his cross, and the Lord will provide. That's the why. It's God providing the substitute. Just as that ram was killed instead of Isaac. So Jesus takes our place as our sacrifice. It seems like all the details of the Jesus story are there. Another way of saying it is this. The promised son of Abraham climbs Jerusalem with wood on his back and is brought back to death on the third day because the Lord provides the substitute. And that sentence is about Isaac, but that sentence is also about Jesus. See all those details coming together in the Isaac story. And maybe most importantly, in this picture of what this teaches us about God and Jesus, you think, well, what does this story mean without Jesus? You know, you have all those details. I believe those details are compelling. But what is this story doing in the Bible? If you don't know about Jesus, if you're a Jewish person, an Israelite, reading this and contemplating this, what does this tell you about God? Does God just cruelly test people? You know, I want to make sure that you really love me, that you're really going to obey me. I got to know. Does God see us as just a puppet? He wants to, you know, guarantee that we're going to put him first. Maybe most significant question of all, is God asking people to do things that he's not willing to do himself? God, you ask us to do all kinds of things for you. And see this example of obedience in the Old Testament, that example. God, you told Isaiah to do this. And you told Jacob to do this. And here you told Abraham to give your only son. Why do you do that? How can you reasonably expect people to do things? Are you willing to do that yourself? And of course, that's the point. Is what we see in the story of Jesus, is God has not asked Abraham to do anything that he's not ultimately going to do himself. What the story means with once we understand Jesus is God is really just asking Abraham to give his best. Because God is, just a few years later, going to give his best. And what is fascinating is that God fulfills all the roles in this story. That God is every major character in this story. Is that God is Abraham giving of his son. God the Father acting in that role. God is the son, the Isaac, the willing sacrifice. I mean, the willingness to carry his cross to his death. The willingness to be bound. You see the story of Jesus in that. And then Jesus is the ram. Jesus is the substitution, the one that takes the place that God provides for the substitute. God fulfilling all those roles in this story. And let me kind of close by offering this perspective. Isaiah 53 is kind of our perspective on the cross, right? We behold him there. He's dying. By his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. The Lord lays on him our iniquity. It's a picture of us looking and seeing Jesus there. Psalm 22 was our focus this morning at the Lord's Supper. And Psalm 22 is Jesus' perspective, right? Why have you forsaken me? Here I am. All my bones are out of joint. I can count all my bones. They divide my garments among them. They pierce my hands and my feet. It's the first person, the cross from Jesus' perspective. And what we have in Genesis 22 is God the Father's perspective. I mean, all those details of Abraham offering his son, his only son, the beloved son. That's God the Father's perspective on the cross. And that just brings us then to the heart of the story. God has provided the sacrifice for our sins. I hope that this is useful. I think that this really provides for us a compelling picture of Jesus from the scriptures, from hundreds of years before he comes on the scene in the first century. And that's not the only story in the Old Testament that does this. But it's more than that, because it shows the heart of God. It shows us the heart of the picture of what Jesus accomplishes. And we see the sacrifice and the suffering of Jesus, and we see the sacrifice of God in giving Jesus. And that was our scripture reading tonight from Romans 5, that God gave his son for us. While we were sinners, God was willing to give Jesus as the sacrifice so that we could be reconciled and brought back to God. And this story points us to that. The sacrifice has been offered. It is done. It is finished. Everything is accomplished in Jesus on the cross. And so the call then is, what are we going to do? Will we come to God and accept that gift? Are we going to respond and say, God, you've given everything. You've given your son. And because of that, I'm going to follow you. This makes us love God all the more, trust God all the more, and want to give ourselves and follow Jesus. I hope that this story touches our heart. I hope that this story increases our faith. I hope that this draws us closer to God. We want to help you come to know God. I mean, if you need prayers, if you need encouragement, if you want to let us know how you want to obey the gospel, even be baptized into Christ, we want to do that anytime, maybe even now, while we stand and sing a song of encouragement.